Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Grace Gotchling. On May 11, 2020, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral argument in McGirt v. Oklahoma, a case which involves a dispute over whether the prosecution of an enrolled member of the Creek Tribe for crimes committed within the historical Creek boundaries is subject to exclusive federal jurisdiction. Petitioner Jim C. McGirt was found guilty of one count of first-degree rape by instrumentation, one count of lewd molestation, and one count of forcible sodomy. McGirt was sentenced to 500 years in prison without parole. On appeal, the Oklahoma court declined to review McGirt's petition. He then filed an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing that Oklahoma courts lacked jurisdiction because the crimes occurred in Indian Country, where McGirt was a member of the Creek Nations of Oklahoma. To discuss the case, we have Troy Ide, shareholder at Greenberg Tarig LLP.
McGirt versus Oklahoma presents some of the most interesting federal Indian law questions of recent years, and specifically those dealing with tribal treaty cases. The Supreme Court has heard a number of different cases that deal with the rights of Native people and of federally recognized Indian tribes. This past term, this last year, they heard three different cases dealing with tribal treaty rights, and the court ruled 5-4 in favor of the tribes in two of the cases, but one case, Carpenter versus Murphy last term, was laid over and was not decided, and now is before the court again this term. And that case is McGirt versus Oklahoma. It's an amazing set of issues and a remarkable set of four attorneys who argued in front of the court. You had a longtime Federal Society member, the Solicitor General of Oklahoma, Muthoon Mansinghani, who clerked for Jerry Smith and is well regarded in Federal Society circles. You had representing the defendants, Mr. McGirt, Ian Gershengorn, who's a longtime advocate in the Supreme Court, and the Creek or Muscogee Nation, Riaz Kanji, who was recently named by Chambers as the superstar of the federal Indian law bench. And then finally, Ed Needler. Many of us know Ed Needler as the individual has argued more cases in front of the U.S. Supreme Court than anybody else in history, and he is with, of course, the U.S. Department of Justice in the Solicitor General's office. The case is a fascinating one, has a lot of aspects, but the main issue is whether the 1866 territorial boundaries of the Muscogee or Creek Nation of Oklahoma, which is roughly one-third of the state of Oklahoma, including the city of Tulsa, which is nearly 700,000 people, still constitutes an Indian reservation. And it matters because of the posture of the case, because if crimes are allegedly committed there and are involving Indians, if it's a reservation still, a federal reservation, it would mean that they are subject to concurrent federal criminal jurisdiction as well as tribal jurisdiction from the Creek Nation. And if not, it means that crimes involving Indians, which is the legal term that Congress uses, Native Americans, but Indians, would be subject to state jurisdiction. It's a fascinating question because for well over 100 years, the assumption has been in the state of Oklahoma that within this area, the state has jurisdiction. But the debate is over whether Congress, in the legal term, is disestablished the reservation. And I'll go through the respective arguments from the different parties and identify who they are. But it gives you an idea of what a fascinating question it is. It involves treaty rights that go back to an 1866 treaty. It involves a lot of different statutes that presage the entry of Oklahoma as the 46th state in the Union in 1907. And it involves questions dealing with criminal jurisdiction that have broad implications on who is going to be policing and ultimately investigating and prosecuting, adjudicating crimes that arise in a large part of the state of Oklahoma. And whether it's going to be a combination of federal and tribal officials, or presumably the way it is now, primarily the state's responsibility to do that enforcement. And then finally, the question is broader in terms of Native American tribes. There are lots of different treaties around the country between tribes and the federal government. And this case has much broader implications if the reservation is viewed as disestablished and the treaty right is no longer valid versus if the treaty right is still valid based upon the way in which Congress has addressed this reservation. Now, just very briefly, for those of you who are interested but might not have that much background in federal Indian law, the U.S. Constitution recognizes four different sovereigns in Article I. You've got, of course, the federal government that's created by the Constitution, the several states, or foreign countries, they're called foreign states in the Constitution, and then Indian tribes. Indian tribes appear in Article I. They also appear in Article II. The president's treaty-making authority extends not only to foreign states, but to Indian tribes. And you finally have in the Constitution Indians identified as such. They appear in Article I. And you may recall that in the original Constitution, you had the allocation of who was going to be able to vote for members of the U.S. House of Representatives. You had African Americans or blacks were counted as 3/5 persons, the slaves of that era. But you also have a phrase in Article 1, Section 14, that speaks of excluding Indians not taxed. And what that meant was that Indians were not part of the original set of consents that gave rise to the Constitution. They were part of a different sovereign, and so it's assumed that they were not part of the United States. And even when you had the Reconstruction Amendments, the 14th Amendment at the end of the Civil War, of course, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments all together, in the 14th Amendment, you have that same language repeated. So even though the issue of slavery was addressed and the 3/5 clause was, of course, eliminated, and we began this very long and at times difficult move to the modern era over many, many decades, you still had that phrase, excluding Indians not taxed, remain in the 14th Amendment. And so what that means, and what the U.S. Supreme Court has said for well over 100 years, is that Indians that who live on reservations or an area that's been set aside by the Congress pursuant to treaty or by the president or by both, Indians that are on their homelands that's in federal status are not citizens of the United States by right of the Constitution, but rather by statute. There was a 1924 statute, the Indian Citizenship Act, that extended U.S. citizenship to Native Americans living on reservations in 1924. And so it's very important to understand that Indian law is something that predates the Constitution, that it was part of what the framers dealt with. It's very much a fixture of the early U.S. Supreme Court cases going back to the court of John Marshall when he was Chief Justice. And it's also a very vigorous area of litigation and practice today. We have 574 federally recognized Indian tribes, nations, pueblos, rancherias, and so on in the United States. And we also have a legacy of other Indian lands, some of which are recognized by states as tribes and have tribal homelands but are not recognized by the federal government. So it's a very interesting set of relationships. And it's one that arises more often in law practice than might be expected. So getting to the case at hand, the McGirt case. In 1866, there was a treaty following the Civil War, and it concerned what had been the Indian Territory. You may recall that during the administration of Andrew Jackson, that the Creek Indians, the Cherokee tribe, and other Native American tribes were removed by presidential action and by also the support of the Congress of that era. They were removed from their homelands on the East Coast, and they were resettled beyond the Mississippi River in what was then called the Indian Territory, a federal territory. And what is now the state of Oklahoma, those boundaries, was at one time the Indian Territory. In 1866, however, at the end of the Civil War, Congress entered into a series of commissions to try to examine the fate of what would happen there as settlement began to occur that was non-Indian settlement in what had been the Indian Territory and still was the Indian Territory at that era. But you saw a lot of settlement going on, and you also had the issue of the newly freed slaves who had in many cases relocated to the Indian Territory, had been sheltered there in some cases, had intermarried, a lot of very complicated historical issues. And so in 1866, it is noteworthy that the president, at that time Andrew Johnson, negotiated a treaty through commissioners, but then presented to the U.S. Senate for ratification, and it was ratified, that set the boundaries for five different tribes within the Indian Territory, essentially one-third of the state of you know, what is now the state of Oklahoma, essentially the area from Tulsa all the way out to nearly Oklahoma City and that south and eastern part of the state, if you were to look at a map. And that area was essentially reserved to five tribes, the Cherokee Nation, the Muscogee or Creek Nation, the Choctaw Tribe, the Chickasaw Tribe, and the Seminole Tribe. All five of those tribes had been relocated from the East Coast during the Trail of Tears decades earlier. But the area of central and western Oklahoma was then opened to non-Indian settlement and was ceded to the United States. That is to say that the rights that those tribes and other tribes had to those lands were ceded to the United States or given over to the United States in exchange for different forms of compensation and so on. This was, of course, done in a very compulsory fashion during that era. And it is noteworthy that the Creek Nation, to a large extent, sided with the Confederacy during the Civil War. And so this was viewed by many in the North and the radical Republicans as just dessert for what had happened in the Civil War, and that the tribes had, in effect, picked the wrong side. So much of the state of Oklahoma was then ceded to the U.S., and what had been the Indian Territory became much smaller. It was about a third of what it had once been. So in 1866, this treaty was entered into. And the case that is now before the Supreme Court concerns the very convoluted and difficult to reconstruct history of what happened between 1866 and Oklahoma statehood in 1907. Did Congress intend to disestablish the reservation, that one-third of eastern and southern Oklahoma? Did they intend to, in effect, when Oklahoma became a state, eliminate the reservation, or what we call in legal practice, disestablish it? Or did they preserve that jurisdiction, and did they take steps to ensure that federal treaty rights were not going to be derogated, even as what eventually became eastern Oklahoma was settled and became, you know, much more populated by non-Indians and eventually overwhelmingly populated by non-Indians. When you look at disestablishment, the U.S. Supreme Court has a very robust body of jurisprudence that deals with this in a lot of cases called Solem v. Bartlett. And so this is where the McGirt analysis really begins. You've got essentially a three-part analysis for how you look at whether an Indian reservation has been disestablished. The first is, what has Congress said? What do the statutes actually say? And the presumption has been that if Congress intends to disestablish a reservation, they have to do so explicitly, which shows respect for the treaty right, and also a canon of construction that respects the rights the tribes have, because, of course, they're sovereigns that predate the government of the United States. The second is to look at the legislative history, and secondarily, what did Congress say about it at the time? And then third, you look at the subsequent demographic history, what's happened to the land in the years past. That's the solemn framework, if you will. It had been upheld several years ago in a decision authored by Justice Clarence Thomas called Nebraska versus Parker, a unanimous decision of the court, reaffirming that solemn analysis in 2017. So that's where the analysis begins. And with that in mind, the state of Oklahoma took the position in the case, supported by the United States, and oral argument reserved between the two of them, but Oklahoma getting the lion's share on that side of the case, that during the process between the 1866 treaty and Oklahoma statehood, that there had been a number of different statutes that ultimately operated to disestablish what had been the Creek Reservation. Number one was the process of allotting Creek lands or breaking them into individual parcels that were allocated to individual Indians or Indian households. The second was to limit the powers of the Creek government. There had been statutes, for example, that abolished the Creek court system, which had been highly developed in that era. Another aspect that the state of Oklahoma emphasized in its oral arguments by the Solicitor General of Oklahoma was that in providing for Oklahoma statehood, Native Americans were participants in that process, and there was an expectation that the Creek Nation and the other tribes would be terminated at the end of the process. And so there was a lot of historical information that was presented. Some of it is not in the record, but was talked about in oral argument, which was a rather distressing part of this case. There have been various instances, as has been pointed out by commentators, where during the course of the oral arguments, in particular, Oklahoma offered statements about the history that were not actually in the record. But setting that aside, there's a voluminous record that deals with what Congress did. And the overall thrust, as the state of Oklahoma put it, was the disestablishment by Congress through a series of statutes. And at that point, by the time of 1907, in effect, the reservation ceased to exist by operation of these different laws. The argument for McGirt and also the support of the intervention in the case by the tribe in question, the Muscogee or Creek tribe, was the following. And just to make it clear, McGirt raised these issues on habeas corpus. He is a member of a different federally recognized tribe, but had committed a felony, murder on lands of the Creek Nation and that the Creek Nation considered to still be within its concurrent criminal jurisdiction. And so after he'd been arrested and convicted and sentenced for this murder in Oklahoma State Court, he filed a post-conviction motion to be released, essentially saying the wrong sovereign had arrested him, that he should have been adjudicated by the federal government's, the Creek Nation's government, or both, and that the state did not have criminal jurisdiction over him. One of the issues that's arisen in the case is, well, does this affect a lot of different people? How many folks would be affected in terms of those who have already committed crimes in the same area who have filed habeas petitions? The state has taken a very high number. Both McGirt's attorney, Ian Gershengorn, and the Creek Nation said it's a relatively low number. The bottom line appears to be that the state of Oklahoma doesn't keep a lot of statistics on this by geography in a way that is particularly definitive. But it certainly is an issue in terms of what the burden is ultimately going to be, depending upon how this case turns out. But the argument that McGirt had and that the Creek Nation, represented by Riaz Kanji, had is that there was never, according to the Solon v. Bartlett framework, a disestablishment of this reservation, that Congress had the chance to eliminate the reservation but did not do so, and that the legislative history didn't show it either, and that Congress, in effect, had decided to continue the Creek Nation indefinitely, had prevented its lands from entering the public domain, and that Congress had taken steps to preserve both tribal rights and federal authority, that they had gotten rid of the tribal courts, for example, but they had kept the Creek Nation's legislative jurisdiction and other aspects of their government, that they assumed that they would be able to continue to work with the Creek Nation and that they would be their trustee, but that ultimately the Enabling Act that admitted Oklahoma into the Union preserved the federal role as it existed at that point, and that Congress had not actually diminished the reservation or terminated the reservation. What the phrase is in the Solem case is hallmark language. You need hallmark language from Congress to show that the Congress indeed intended to disestablish, rather, the reservation. You need hallmark language to show that Congress intended to disestablish the reservation, and that there was no hallmark language, quote unquote, from the Congress that dealt with the cession of lands in what is now the Creek Nation. So that's essentially the issue that we've got, is a very fascinating treaty interpretation concerning a large land base. And you may ask yourself, well, what difference does it really make? Well, it makes potentially a substantial difference in that it's about a 3 million acre area that, at least with respect to crimes committed that involve Indians, would, if McGirt wins, be subject to concurrent federal jurisdiction as well as tribal jurisdiction, where the feds are not currently providing that support. So you need a very substantial increase in federal resources and a recognition of federal jurisdiction to enforce two laws, the Major Crimes Act of 1885, which involves crimes committed by Indians against other Indians, and also something called the Indian Country Crimes Act, which involves crimes committed by non-Indians against Indians, an earlier statute. Those are the two principal federal statutes that would apply. And so those would have to be extended and then enforced to the territory that's now being policed, and in which cases are now adjudicated by the Oklahoma state courts. The issue has arisen, well, isn't this a pretty massive shift in what people expected? And also, if you look at the Solon v. Bartlett framework, the subsequent demographic history is such that this is overwhelmingly a non-Indian area. And so should we not factor that in? And the bottom line is, on the other side, from the standpoint of the Creek Nation and from McGirt and his attorneys, the argument has been, well, you may be correct, but that's an issue for the Congress to figure out. It is the case in federal Indian law that Congress has what's called plenary power. Plenary means, in effect, absolute power over tribes. You see this in cases in the very late 19th century, early 20th century, a 1903 case called Lone Wolf versus Hitchcock, involving what was then the Indian Territory, which says that Congress can certainly allocate the powers however they want. They can recognize treaties. They can modify treaties. Congress can also eliminate treaties. They have the absolute power to determine the relationship with the tribes. And they therefore apply to McGirt, in this case, are the ones that should be able to determine what happens next. So that if Mr. McGirt wins and the Creek Nation's jurisdiction is upheld, even though it would be a surprise to many, Congress can still address that issue because it has the plenary power. In support of that position, I was part of a team of former United States attorneys. I'd served in the Bush administration as the United States Attorney for Colorado. But we had a bipartisan group of U.S. attorneys. And in full disclosure, we filed a brief in the case that was supportive of the position of the Creek Nation and the legal position espoused by Mr. McGirt. And that is to say that we view this as a separation of powers case. It's a straight-up case as to whether the treaty right will be respected. And if the treaty right is respected, as we think it's clear Congress did not disestablish the reservation, then the way to address this would be for Congress to simply look at the jurisdiction and decide if it needs to be modified. And one of the arguments that we made involves looking at other recent examples where Congress has said we want to change the allocation of jurisdiction among tribes and states in the federal government. There's one in my own state of Colorado in 1984, a statute called Public Law 290, and it concerned a reservation of about 750,000 acres in southwest Colorado, the Southern Ute Indian Reservation. And at that time, the tribe and the surrounding municipalities and the two counties, as well as the federal government, all sat down, and they decided to reallocate criminal jurisdiction. They broke out the largest city on the reservation, which had been in tribal jurisdiction concurrent with the federal government, and then Congress shifted that to state jurisdiction with the consent of all concerned, including the tribe. And so there are other examples, but we and others have pointed out to the court in our briefs that Congress does have this ability, and they've used it even in recent times to be able to reposition which jurisdiction does what for the overall benefit of public safety and the administration of justice. An answer to that or a rebuttal to that might be that the citizens of Oklahoma have for generations built many expectations around this current status quo. And While it's true that crimes involving non-Indians would still be subject to state jurisdiction, because that's longstanding U.S. Supreme Court precedent going back to the 1880s, crimes involving Indians would now suddenly go into federal jurisdiction, and that it's unlikely from the standpoint of the state of Oklahoma that there would be as much accountability if the feds did something that the state has been doing for so many decades, state government being closer to the people, being the perception being more responsive to their needs and interests and priorities, as opposed to the federal government as a more remote and less accountable body to do the policing and enforcement and the adjudication and whatnot. So that in summary is the McGirt case. It is clear, I think, to all concerned that regardless of which way the case goes, it's going to be very significant for both states that have Indian nations within their boundaries and might potentially have disputes with them, and certainly for federally recognized Indian tribes that may have treaties that need some type of adjudication or interpretation in order to determine the relative allocation of power. So this is a very closely watched case. I would simply say that in recent years, as I mentioned at the outset of this, the court has been relatively solicitous of tribal treaty rights cases. This past term, we had the case Herrera versus Wyoming, and by a vote of 5-4, it struck down a ruling by the Wyoming Supreme Court. And in that case, there was a Crow tribal member. The Crow tribe had a treaty when they ceded lands to the United States, and that the treaty said that they could still hunt off reservation for subsistence and other purposes, ceremonial purposes and whatnot. And so even though their reservation is in Montana, you had Mr. Herrera hunting an elk. He goes into Wyoming. He shoots the elk there. He gets arrested by a Wyoming game warden. And what he says is, well, hey, I'm a Crow Nation tribal citizen. I have a treaty right. You can't arrest me because this is a federal right that's in a treaty. And the U.S. Supreme Court agreed with the tribal member's position, upheld the Crow tribe's treaty with the United States, and said that the Crow Nation's off-reservation hunting rights were not terminated when Wyoming became a state in 1889. And then there was a second case that also came out 5-4 in favor of the tribal position, the Washington State Department of Licensing versus Cougar Den. Cougar Den had to do with taxation of state fuel. There was a tribal company in Washington State on a reservation, the Yakima Nation's reservation, and they were importing gasoline products from another state and went across the boundary. The state of Wyoming, or I'm sorry, Washington wanted to tax that, but the tribe said, well, no, you can't do that because we have a right to travel provision in our treaty. We should be able to import this without paying state taxes. And again, the Supreme Court agreed with the tribal position. It's significant because those are both 5-4 decisions, and Justice Neil Gorsuch was the swing vote in both of those cases. Justice Gorsuch has a reputation of being a very pro-tribal sovereignty justice. And so everyone's watching what Justice Gorsuch might do in this particular case, the McGirt case. The last predecessor case last term, which raised very similar issues to McGirt, was called Carpenter versus Murphy. But in that case, it had come up through the Tenth Circuit. Then Tenth Circuit Judge Neil Gorsuch had been involved with the case. And so when he got to the Supreme Court, he recused himself. The case turned out 4-4. And therefore, you know, what is now the McGirt case came up this term involving the same issues. But the difference being that Justice Gorsuch is not recused from this case. He wasn't involved in the earlier case. It arose post Carpenter versus Murphy on post-conviction relief. And so everyone's watching to see what Justice Gorsuch might do. And when you listen to the oral arguments, it was quite clear that there were a lot of very probing questions, not just from Justice Gorsuch, but from all the justices, especially with the new format that we're all enjoying hearing so many different questions and getting so many questions that we can actually make out as opposed to them talking over each other. A little bit of editorial comment. So I hope you've enjoyed this presentation. If you want more information, I really encourage you to take a look at the Federalist Society website, not only for this case, but for all the cases involving SCOTUS. And I wish you all well, and thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. SCOTUS Cast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUS Cast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.